Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, and welcome back, everyone. Glad you're with us for another week. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, one of the four contributors to the Money Tree Podcast. And we're going to meet all of them in just a second. But first, have you ever wondered if there were a way that you could capitalize on all that online chatter that you read whenever you go on social media? Well, guess what? The wait's over, because the same artificial intelligence techniques that some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds use, that's now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, which is licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trades under ticker symbol BUZ, gives investors a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. What does that mean? It means they don't use surveys, they don't guess, they just listen. Here's how it works. First, they target the most mentioned large cap US stocks across the social media landscape. And if a conversation's really active, then the reliability of the buzz goes up. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks that have the most bullish score, those then get included in the index. And each month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, which positions Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index, more information, and to get the Buzz Index newsletter. And now let's turn things over to the host with the most, Doug Goldstein.
Okay, I'm very excited to be talking with Spencer Jacob from the Wall Street Journal. You've probably seen the Heard on the Street column, which he edits. And he also just wrote a book called Heads I Win, Tails I Win, Why Smart Investors Fail and How to Tilt the Odds in Your Favor. Spencer, I really would like to tilt the odds in my favor, but people often tell me, you know, there's nothing you can do because you can't control the market. And, you know, we all know that no one can really beat it on a consistent basis. So can someone beat the market on a consistent basis?
Well, it depends how you look at it. I mean, let's think about it this way. There are dozens of books out there and thousands of people out there literally who are trying to give you an edge. And as you point out, they generally don't succeed. And people who try to get an edge don't succeed with sort of, you know, positive advice. This is what you need to do. This is what you need to buy. This is how you need to invest. This is how you need to think about the market. I think that at the margin, some of those can be, you know, useful, but they're mildly useful, and they're only useful to people who are extremely disciplined and smart about employing them. On the other hand, there is a huge amount of low-hanging fruit out in the market, because a typical investor is actually very bad. People don't realize, even about themselves, if they look at their own investment performance, how bad it is compared to just a completely passive strategy. When I say to people, like, you know, if you're a typical investor and you follow this advice more or less, you could double or triple your nest egg over your saving lifetime. That sounds pretty good, but it's really the avoidance of errors and mistakes that are key to it.
Well, what are the low-hanging fruit? Does that mean there are some really good bargains out there?
It doesn't mean that, I mean, there could, of course, be, and I don't know what the bargains are. And by the way, no one else does either. I mean, pundits are, you know, generally useless or slightly more than useless in terms of following about specific advice. Do I buy Apple? Do I sell Apple? And whatnot. But the low-hanging fruit is very, very clearly there in terms of, it really boils down to two things. One is the sort of the things that investors do, the sort of zigging when they should zag, the way that people invest and the way that people psychologically and practically approach the market. Another thing is the amount of money that people pay to be invested, some of the costs they're not even aware of that they incur upon themselves, and taxes and transaction fees and things like that, that are absolutely unnecessary, like a true waste of money. And if you look at that, you know, let's say, Doug, you know, you were working in finance, you know, and say you and, you know, your brother both inherit a large sum of money, right? And the person says, well, Doug, you know, you obviously know what you're doing. You can take this money. You can't spend it, but you just invest it however you see fit, any mutual fund you want, you know, and in 30 years you can touch the money. And your brother can't touch it. He has to put it in the absolute lowest cost passive index fund, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, rebalanced, can't do anything. Your brother probably would have something like, after 30 years, and this is exaggerated because we're starting with a lump sum. This is not how most people invest. Something on the order of 4 to 5 times as much money as you, if you are merely typical not bad, merely typical. And that's shocking, right? I mean,
it's funny that you're saying that. And of course, the numbers really do play out. We do see that when people work so hard to try and beat the market, they just don't. But you started your career as a pundit. You were in fact, a stock analyst, right? You were one of these geniuses that people turn to, and you still are a genius that people turn to.
You were
adding value to the equation. It seems to me that the problem is people just don't know how to deal with all the information out there. And maybe the answer is if you don't know how to deal with it, so go just with a basic index fund. And of course, you have to choose which one, but that's a different question.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the vast majority of people, that passive approach is right. And yeah, I was an analyst, and now I write columns and edit columns in the Wall Street Journal that people take as investment advice. And the people here, obviously, they do a great job, and they're very smart. And you look on TV, I mean, they're the occasional sort of, you know, bozo that you see on CNBC or Bloomberg TV or whatever. But the vast majority of people who are interviewed for their knowledge about some subject, let's say about the next iPhone or their investment prowess or whatever, what they're saying makes sense. It's the facts are correct. They've put a lot of effort into learning it. You know, they have expensive educations. What they're saying is not wrong. They have a sophisticated understanding of it. What they don't do, and this is demonstrably true, is they don't add anything to security selection, because what they're saying is sort of, you know, is more or less reflected in the market. And, you know, they don't have a sense of what to do when. And if they did, they wouldn't be telling you. I mean, they would be, you know, it's those who say don't know and those who know don't say. Those people are, but even the people who are giving you explicit advice, buy this now, sell that now, and then wind up giving you bad advice, they'll excuse away their mistakes. I mean, most people who are out there in the pundit business are not con men. A few are, but they sort of con themselves into thinking that they're better than they are. And some have decent track records, but it's very difficult to say, it's impossible to say if their track records are, you know, the result of luck or skill. But over a large group of people, you can see that pundits are just a coin flip. I mean, in studies have been done, you know, you look at the proclamations of well-known pundits in the market, there's just no reason to follow them. And the fact that they've been right three times in a row, or they told you to buy Apple 10 years ago, doesn't matter. You know, that doesn't have any bearing on the next thing they're going to tell you.
Right. A lot of these people could be sort of a black swan in the situation. We're talking with Spencer Jacob, who wrote the book Heads I Win, Tails I Win. He's talking to us from the newsroom at the Wall Street Journal, where he edits the Heard on the Street column. Spencer, I want to dive into this question that a lot of people have about index funds. And frankly, I'm involved in the index fund market too as an advisor, as a financial advisor. I work with people trying to help them to put together portfolios. One of the issues is today there are so many index funds and lots of them have low costs, so it's not really an issue. And you can put your money in and not pay a lot. But the people themselves, of course, often end up messing themselves up. But even before they have the chance to mess up and, you know, sell low and buy high, how would you suggest that someone choose, if he wants to make a portfolio of index funds, how do you choose what index to get into?
Well, I think that the broadest, most representative index in any category is generally the best choice. I mean, like you can buy the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index, which is or the equivalent given by other providers. I'm not really endorsing one product over the other. You want, you know, you're buying an exchange traded fund especially, and it applies less to a traditional mutual fund. You know, you want the big liquid one, the one that turns over a lot, because your transaction costs getting into and out of them are the lowest. And you want that one that's most representative of the market. The S&P 500 is fine. That's about 86% of the value of U.S. stocks, if you're talking about the U.S., but you can go even broader than that. You know, a well-balanced portfolio should have those large capitalization stocks, but should have some stocks from outside the United States, should have some bonds, should have some real estate, should be, you know, basically diversified. You know, if you look at what a robo-advisor will do for you, for example, you know, they'll choose five or six, you know, very low-cost index funds and then rebalance them. And that tends to dampen volatility. And volatility is what spooks people and makes people make bad decisions. And so dampening that volatility month to month, year to year, is kind of has a positive side effect of making you less nervous and causing you to make fewer errors, you know, cognitively.
I think what also kind of spooks people, and please don't take this the wrong way, but is the media. The media is out there with, you know, the headlines. They got professional headline writers meant to either frighten people or excite them. What role do you think the media actually plays in normal people making really bad investment mistakes?
Well, guilty as charged. I mean, we're not out to spook people, but I mean, there's the saying that if it bleeds, it leads. You know, you're not going to say nothing happened today or everything's fine or don't read this. You know, you're going to tell people why something is important, why something is shocking, you know, why you know, bad news prevails over good news. If you look at, you know, there was an interesting study done by a group called Bespoke Investment Group where they looked at the Drudge headline indicator. Drudge, you know, if there's a big headline, then they'll put it on top of the Drudge report. And when Drudge had a financial headline or didn't have a financial headline, i.e. when finance, and generally, you know, that market went up five days in a row is not a headline. Market has gone down 5 days in a row. Dow has gone down 1,000 points, you know, in the last seven sessions or something like that, you know, then financial news is big. And there is a perfect inverse correlation between, you know, in terms of like, you know, when the Drudge headline indicator was at its highest, when things were really scary, things were bad, that was the time to actually be investing. That preceded very good returns in the market. It's the scariest of times. It's the times when people are least likely to contribute to a stock fund, most likely, in fact, to be withdrawing money from a stock fund.
So they're doing exactly the opposite of what they should do based on the news, either frightening them or exciting them.
That's right. But the news is a reflection of, you know, listen, I mean, I don't write a column anymore where I call people up and say, hey, tell me what happened in the market, but there's people here who do. And the news reflects what people in the market are saying, and they want to get quoted, and they want to be dramatic too, and you know, and we want people to read our stories.
I mean,
we're not manipulating
people.
I'm not
holding you responsible for this.
No, we're not manipulating people, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, you would, let's say, I would say that the perfect time to, let's say, to up your allocation to stocks would be when, not the Wall Street Journal, but when, let's say, your local paper, to the extent there are local papers anymore, has a headline that's about the stock market. That's a great day to buy, you know, when basically even people who don't pay very much attention to the stock market are informed about how bad things just were. That's quite a good time. I'm not suggesting any timing strategy based on news headlines, but you're absolutely right that it does a disservice to people to sort of invest on the basis of what's in the headlines. And what I advise people to do is to the greatest extent possible, be mechanical, be kind of robotic about the way they invest, because that will insulate you from making any kind of emotional decision. And on the flip side as well, when something is very hot and you feel like a fool for not being in it or not chasing a trend, just ignore it. I mean, you know, the problem is 95% of people are going to be, you know, better served by just ignoring that stuff. It's hard to do, but
it's much easier said than done, because the reality is, you know, you've been working and working and working, saving, and your $150,000 IRA all of a sudden drops to $85,000. You go, you know, what was I doing here? And you want me to put more money into it? I think people get crazy. I actually saw a little while ago a study, and I just don't remember where it was. Maybe you've seen this, that they looked at people who invested with the benefit of the news and people invested without the benefit of the news. And it turned out that those who weren't looking at the news actually did better over time. Even if it's not true,
there are many, many studies like that. There's a famous study that, for example, that looked anonymously at, I think, 33,000 brokerage accounts, discount brokerage accounts, and it adjusted for taxes and costs and everything. It just kind of looked at, you know, who trades the most and who trades the least. And the frequency with which people trade led to consistently to poorer returns. The people who got the best returns were those who traded the least. And there's another study done by a professor at Columbia Business School showed that people who check their portfolio more often do worse. You know, so even just looking at your portfolio, obviously every once in a while you have to do your taxes and things like that. But you know, it's funny. My mom, I asked her a couple of years ago, like, "What does your taxes?" And she said, "Oh, I pay some guy." You know, and her taxes are not very complicated. Like, "Mom, I'll do your taxes for you. Don't pay
You're a good boy."
And then she told me, she told me, you know, she's retired. But then she said, "You know, I got this letter. I owe some capital gains on it." Was actually an Israeli company that she that, you know, was on NASDAQ that she had bought many years ago. I can remember back when you could first trade in online stocks. And I opened an account. I put the money in my checking account in this account, but I forgot I had it because I only bought two stocks and I didn't pay dividends. And I just eventually forgot that I had that thing, and they never sent me a letter. And then the Israeli company got bought. I can't remember what the company was, and she had some capital gain. It's like, okay, great. You know, this is like the 90s that she had done this. What's the other company? Amazon.com. You know, I mean, it wasn't a lot of money that she invested at the time, but I think it's worth as much as her apartment or something. You know,
right,
I mean, it's
nice.
You know, and you know, you think it went up several thousand percent, went down 90%, went up a ton, went down another almost 90%. You know, all these crazy things, but she was oblivious to them because she, you know, I mean, I don't recommend forgetting that you own something, you know, but she was insulated, because she just was forgetful and had forgotten that she'd opened this account. But of course, I don't recommend buying two stocks and doing that, because your chances are not too great doing that. But the more that you can
not
be like that and insulate yourself, the better off you are, because you're giving yourself the gift of time and compounding. And the more you get into it, the worse you're going to do. Statistically, obviously, there are exceptions, but on average, it will erode your returns. There's no doubt.
Yeah, I think Eugene Fama, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, said that investing, it's like managing money is like soap. The more you handle it, the smaller it gets.
Yeah.
Spencer, that study that you cited a minute ago about the 30,000 brokerage accounts was done by Terrence Odine from the University of California.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
He was actually, I'm just going to mention this, then we got to wrap up. He was a guest on my show, the Goldstein on Gelt show. If anyone out there wants to listen to that interview, just, I guess you can see it on YouTube, just go to Goldstein on Gelt and Terrence Odine, and he talked about that study. But that's not the topic of our interview today. We've been talking with Spencer Jacob, who is the Heard on the Street column editor at the Wall Street Journal, and he's also the author of the book Heads I Win, Tails I Win, Why Smart Investors Fail, and How to Tilt the Odds in Your Favor. Spencer, in the last few seconds, just tell us, how can people follow you and follow your work?
I can be followed on Twitter, and I have an unusual spelling of my surname, so it's at Spencer Jacob, SpencerJacab. I can be followed at SpencerJacob.com, same spelling, obviously, and you can read my articles. I still do write a couple of times a week at the Wall Street Journal. Look for my byline, and then listen to things like this.
All right, and check out the book as well. We will put links to all of that at the show notes of today's show. Spencer Jacob, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Hey, before we get into the second half of our great conversation and bring in all of our contributors, have you ever wondered if there were a way that you could take advantage of all the people that talk about stocks, bonds, and investments on social media? Well, guess what? You can, because the same artificial intelligence techniques that hedge funds use, you can now use by investing in the Buzz Index. It trades under ticker symbol BUZ and gives investors a portfolio of securities that have the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. And what does that mean? It means that they take a look at all of the conversations people are having. They don't use surveys. They don't guess. Instead, they take the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater reliability of the buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks that are the most bullish scores, those get included in the index. So now, positive online chatter becomes your greatest weapon. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. I invest in the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you, but I should disclose that that's in my portfolio. All right, let's go to the second half of the show. And nice job, Doug.
Hey, Joe, thanks so much for the great introduction and the great update on what's going on with the Buzz Index. I think today we have a full team, starting with the one and only Linda P. Jones. Linda, how you doing?
I was wondering who you were going to say.
Yeah, me too.
I'm doing great. How are you? It's great to have everybody back. We missed you guys.
Yeah, it's fun. How was the conference, guys?
Oh, it was the best conference ever.
And
fantastic.
Joe won an award. Let's not forget that Joe won an award.
He did. Stacking Benjamins. Great job, Joe.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. I owe a judge somewhere $20, I guess. I don't know. But it's still surreal. So thank you. I can't believe a little show like ours over Tim Ferriss and How I Built This. And of course, the Money Tree podcast, which should have won. We got to talk about that.
Hey,
well,
we'll
work on it for next year.
Yeah.
Actually, I think we're doing very well. But the fact is, Stacking Benjamins is one of like the top shows on iTunes, top shows out there. So good for you. Well deserved. You really did a great job.
Well deserved. Bravo.
Thank you.
And Randy, you're doing pretty well. How are things going? You happy to be back with your feet on the ground?
I am. I'm super excited because I don't think I have to go anywhere for the entire month of September. So it's an exciting thing to be home and, just be home.
All right. So let's talk about excitement, because I want to relate back to the interview that we had with Spencer Jacob. Cool to bring on someone from the Wall Street Journal. You know, one of the things that he said, which I sort of thought was funny, is because he had previously been a stock analyst and now he's on the media side. In fact, as I would say, someone like Joe is, he used to be a financial guy and now he's on the media side teaching about it. But one of the things that it seems to me, a lot of the people who talk about stock picking and investment strategies, they're kind of like actors. They really juice it up a little bit to try and get people excited. And I'm beginning to wonder if there's a lot of value added to people, or if it's just another form of entertainment, you know, like Mad Magazine. Miranda, do you think that the information people get from, you know, shows like the Money Tree podcast, or maybe some of the smaller shows like Jim Cramer, is this entertainment or is this really useful for them?
Well, so I think it's probably a mix of both. It can be entertaining. I mean, I like watching Jim Cramer smash stuff. I think that's fun. And, you know, Joe is funny and you're funny. So, you know, this can be entertaining. But at the same time, I do think that there is some value in it as long as you keep your head about you and keep in mind your own personal priorities and your own investing style. But I do think that there are definite nuggets of truth to glean out as long as you can push away the sensationalism. We don't get in for sensationalism here on our show. So you do need to be careful about that, though. Watch out if somebody's like yelling a lot and screaming about how you have to do something immediately. That's a red flag. But you can find some nuggets of information depending on your investment style and your goals.
And now we have Linda P. Jones. Linda, what do you think of what Miranda said? Linda, I think you're very funny, too. And I'm not screaming, but gosh, I am very excited because you, for example, Linda, you speak very reasonably. And true, it's funny, but really a lot of what you teach is you just spell it out to people. And I find that's very useful. And Miranda's saying you have to glean information, but wouldn't it be smarter for everyone, let's say seriously, just to listen to a show like Linda's and just get the bottom line instead of trying to figure out from a little bit from this show and a little bit from that show? Because let's face it, not everyone knows enough to figure out what the truth is and what's, you know, what's a little bit hyperbole.
Well, here's the thing. I think analysts are doing a different job because the analysts will actually go out to the companies, meet with the management of the company, talk with them about what are their future plans, what are they doing, what new products do they have coming out. And then they go back to their office and they put together a whole report on prospective earnings and profitability and growth and all kinds of projections, which is great. But, you know, they give us a report from the company, from their perspective. I remember back in the day when I worked for a big firm, there was a particular technology analyst that everybody waited on the edge of their chair every year to hear what she was going to say about technology and which company she liked. And she became very famous as an analyst. So, you know, while I don't read a lot of analyst reports and it's not something that I seek out too much, I do kind of notice whether they have a buy for a company or whether they're, you know, they have a hold. They rarely put a sell. But, you know, I think about Warren Buffett and he doesn't really listen to analysts. He reads the annual reports. He gets it straight from the horse's mouth. So totally different style there. I think, you know, it's sort of an adjunct piece of information for me. It's not something that's basic to my investing, but you know, I'll glance at it once in a while. It's interesting, but they do a lot of work and they do have a specific purpose, I think.
Okay, so Linda, you are being very generous to them, like Spencer Jacob was. Joe, let me ask you, because you really are on the entertainment financial side, you say it on your show, and I do know that you joke around a lot that people shouldn't listen to the Stacking Benjamins show in order to learn, but let's face it, there actually is a lot of useful information there. But what Linda's saying is that you can listen to the analysts because they're doing the research that you can't or aren't really going to do yourself. You're not going to figure out what the earnings estimates are. But I'm wondering what the real value is because, you know, there's so many studies that show that the equity analysts, they're often, not just sometimes, but often getting their earnings forecasts completely off, and certainly their stock price estimates completely off, and they reset it whenever a bad piece of news comes out, and you know, so it's kind of hard for the normal person to track. What do you think? If they are they just blowing a lot of hot air?
You know, I think to some degree, yes, but I think that just for the average investor out there, it's too much information. I don't think that the average investor needs all the information that I hear from analysts. In fact, I was looking at some analysts. Reports about some of the things that they like and some mutual fund managers about the stocks that they like. And I was reading down through the copy thinking, how much of this does Joe Sixpack like me, how much of this do I really need to know? If I'm Miranda Marquette and I'm investing in an index, I don't need to know that the Fidelity Growth Fund manager really likes Amazon right now. And the reasons why they like Amazon because of, you know, this earnings call, this thing that they did, this thing that they expect them to do next. I don't need any of that. So I think that while it isn't necessarily hot air per se. It's noise for the average person.
All right. So a little entertainment. Otherwise, I think it would get a little bit boring because probably, you know, the most boring investor on this panel. Well, I don't want to say Miranda, but, you know, let's face it. Miranda is an indexer. It's not that exciting to talk about. Miranda, there are so many indexes out there. It's not like the good old days when there was one index fund. You know, oh, are you going to invest in a mutual fund or are you going to buy the S&P 500 fund? There must be thousands of different index funds that people can buy. How do you decide which one without getting deep into the research?
Oh, dear. So as you say, I am, you know, boring. My investment style is not sexy. But so I think when I'm looking for something to invest in, I am all about a broad swath of the market. I am all about going as broad as I can. So I like an all market, an all U.S., I should say, an all U.S. market index, or I like an all world index if I want to get some geographic diversification in there. And then I like, you know, bond indexes that include U.S. treasuries, particularly TIPS that are inflation protected. And so I kind of look at it in terms of, you know, and then finally, I also like dividend, you know, any sort of index fund that pays like a dividend. There's a great Dividend Aristocrats index fund that I like. But, you know, even if you don't specifically go for that, if you get a broad-based market fund, most of them pay dividends anyway. So it's cool. So as far as I'm concerned, to me, it's all about, can I get a broad swath of the market and can I do it cheaply? So depending on where you're at, like there are, you know, the Fidelities of the world, the Vanguards of the world, they have a whole collection of broad-based funds, all market, all world, S&P 500, whatever. They have those and you can get them without paying fees, without paying transaction fees or without paying loads. And so something like that makes a lot of sense. And then also in these other brokerages, you can get index ETFs, exchange traded funds. And so, you know, there are plenty of brokerages, TradeKing, E-Trade, all of those types of brokerages usually have a collection of index ETFs that don't come with transaction fees. Now, you're still going to have to pay the expense ratio, but they are there. And then, of course, the robo-advisors all offer these broad-based funds as well. So as far as I'm concerned, it's all about covering the broadest base at a relatively cheap price, you know, reducing my fees, covering a broad base, and moving forward from there using an asset allocation that matches my risk profile.
Doug, can I say one more thing about analysts, too, to get back to that for a second? Which is that when analysts speak publicly, realize that they are on the public relations arm of the game. So while an analyst might have a job to do internally, externally, their number one job is to sell the fund, right? So they're going to bring you the most sexy things that they're doing. And so if I'm watching those, you know, to Linda's point where she says they can be helpful, I think I have to look through what the analyst is saying about the fund. Whatever sounds sexy, get rid of that and try to look for any nuggets that can help me as an investor. If I'm an investor who invests in individual stocks and I want to hear from analysts about what they're thinking, I'm really going to go into any interview skeptical, and then I'm going to look for the hints that are different than what you'd expect them to say that their PR department really wants them to say about the fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like, Joe, the skepticism you bring to the table. My take on this is that I think it's important for people to diversify, much like Miranda's talking about. I just find it so difficult to know which specific indexes or funds or ETFs to buy, which is why I like to put an overlay of an institutional level money manager managing my money. Let them do the research and keep an eye on it because, you know, people tune into shows like the Money Tree podcast. They get some ideas. But I don't know how many of them are going to stick to managing their portfolio literally for the decades that they're going to be investing. Well, maybe our listeners do, but the normal guy is not necessarily going to be sticking with it forever. So you need to have a system that's going to keep you in line. Hey, Linda, you know, Joe is talking about the nuggets you can get from analysts. And I think this speaks to a lot of what you do because you teach about individual stock selection, but you also talk about on Miranda's side, and I think a big part of what you do is the concept of indexing. How do you bring these two together to actually make nuts and bolts decisions about investing?
Well, actually, I don't teach about individual stock selection, but I use indexes to invest and to make a portfolio for people. So how I like to put together ETFs are I like to use large cap, mid cap, small cap, international, and then some sector funds like real estate like the Buzz Index or other specialty things, maybe a little bit of precious metals, you know, just a small slice of the portfolio in those kind of ETFs. I think for beginning investors and people who are just getting their portfolios going, ETFs are the best way to go because they are broadly diversified and they're low fee. And let's face it, most managers haven't outperformed the indexes, so why pay extra fees when you haven't gotten extra performance? In your case, Doug, I think when you work with more affluent investors, then you can look at money managers. And that's smart because those money managers have outperformed the indexes and it's worth paying extra to have that outperformance. But for most people, it's if they're just getting started or they're building a portfolio, I think you want to have lots of diversification, even among your ETFs. And I think you want to, you know, be able to build a portfolio with those that are low fee. And that's a great way to start.
I think that one theme that we're all focusing on here is diversification. One of the types of companies that advertises that they are really good at diversifying because they have mechanical or computer algorithms to do this are the robo-advisors. Now, Joe Saul-Sehy, I know that you love robo-advisors. Tell me why.
I do not.
Oh, really? Oh, love, tell me why that is.
Well, it is not that I love them or hate them. I think that they are I don't think there's any advisor there. I think that, you know, it's a robotic way to get asset allocation in modern portfolio theory, which is fine. But I think when you start comparing a robot to an advisor, I think you have two totally different things. So do I think that a robo-advisor can be one of those systems that people can use, which will be better than just investing in, you know, one straight index like the total U.S. stock market index? Absolutely. I think they can. Do I think that the robo is going to be the person that keeps you on the straight and narrow when your behavior starts to get erratic because the market has dropped a ton lately? No, I don't think the robo is going to be there. And I don't think that's their job. But I think a lot of people think that that's their job. So, you know, I got frustrated last year when Betterment decided to limit people's trading because they were kind of playing the advisor hat in the robo advisor role, which is fine for them to do, except that never seemed to be part of the bargain before they actually did it, which shocked a lot of people. So defining what a robo-advisor is and what a robo-advisor isn't, I think, is an important task that we're going to find out more about in the future.
Yeah. And I think to Joe's point, it's very interesting as we've watched this robo-advisor space grow that so many of them are starting to look for ways to inject that human element into it. You know, like we've got places like Wealthfront and we've got places like Future Advisor who are ostensibly on the surface like robo-advisors, but they also have these services where you can talk to an advisor. They have somebody personal who's going to, you know, help you arrange things once you hit a certain account balance. And so I think it's interesting to note that, these robo-advisors can be great for beginners. It can be a good way to get your feet wet. It can be a good way to keep you from like freaking out and doing something weird with your market event. But people eventually want a human to talk to them about their money. And so I think it's interesting that many of these robo-advisors are starting to add that human element into the mix for those who do want to talk to somebody.
Well, there's even a different aspect to that. You know, the reason I asked, and I'll just be upfront about this, I asked M1 Finance to sponsor the Stacking Benjamin show is because, you know, they don't pretend to be the human element, but what they will do, different than like a Betterment, is instead of giving you just a few of these pies, you can create your own if you want. So they'll do all the things that the robo does, but if you want to take more control but keep the asset allocation the same, you can. So instead of worrying about whether they're a robo or not, they don't call themselves a robo at all, which I love. They don't call themselves advisor, right? I think there's a lot of robo. There's no advisor. They don't even pretend to do that. But now they embrace the part of what I think the robo really should be embracing, which is, hey, be as flexible as you want, be as rigid as you want, make it as easy as you want, make it as diversified as you want. But we're going to take over all the stuff that the robo part should be doing. So I like the robo. The advisor part is driving me crazy.
Semantics, Joe. It's all just semantics.
Right. Do you want to see the dogs and the ponies?
When you talk about adding the human component to this, all of a sudden we're getting emotions involved because that's really what it means. We're saying, let me listen to what your feelings are and what you're worried about and what your goals are. These are all very emotional issues. And we've certainly spoken many times on the show about the behavioral finance risk that people have when they let their emotions get into it. Linda, don't you think it's better if you have just a rock solid system, even if it's not the best system that you could possibly have, but at least a system that people stick with. And don't robo-advisors provide that?
Well, they do. But what I was going to say, kind of based on the last question, is, you know, there's this whole trend toward artificial intelligence, and there's this whole trend toward eliminating the human out of everything. I mean, if you read about AI, that's kind of the whole goal. I went to a restaurant and they had the whole menu on an electronic pad, and you know, you had to check out yourself, and it was a big chain of restaurants that's well known from Australia. You might know who that is. And so they're, you know, all different types of businesses are doing this robo situation. But I think when it comes to people's money, they want to have a relationship with someone. They want to be able to talk with someone and find out where their money is or what's going on. And the hardest part about investing isn't the selection of the ETF or following the market or that. It's staying calm when the market, you know, has volatility and has very sharp volatility, because we know once every 10 years, on average, the market's going to decline by at least 20%. And we haven't had that yet in this 10-year period. But the 10 years isn't up yet. But it has happened every 10-year period in history. And so when that happens, investors need to have someone to talk to hold their hand. And I've always found that was the most valuable role that a financial advisor could play, in my opinion.
I totally agree with Linda. I think that the system is not the problem. I mean, I do think it's a problem, Doug, that investors sometimes don't have systems, or that they skip from system to system to system. In that case, having a system isn't the problem. It's people's adherence to the system that's the problem.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, people need to adhere to something. And I know that we all we need to, of course, adhere to our time frame. And we're just about out of time. But in the last few seconds, let's just see what's going on with everyone. Let me start with Miranda. What is going on, Miranda, with you?
Yeah, so head on over to studentloanhero.com. I've been writing a lot about investing lately. We've been talking about stock picking and why you should avoid it. Don't read it, Linda. Go away. But talking about stock picking, I interviewed William Bernstein about it, an investing luminary about it, a neurologist and financial theorist. And so that's up there at the Student Loan Hero blog. And then I've also written an interesting thing about employers and why they should start offering student loan repayment benefits to their employees, and how Congress should consider making those things tax advantaged, just like, 401k contributions are. So head on over to the Student Loan Hero blog and check out what I've been working on.
All right. And Linda P. Jones, who doesn't pick individual stocks, tell us what's going on, what you really are doing these days.
I think it's confusing because I made a lot of money in individual stocks, so people think that's what I teach, but it isn't. I really teach everyone to invest using ETFs. I think that's the best way to start and for most people to invest. So that may clear up some of the confusion. On Be Wealthy and Smart, we have 7 things you need to do immediately if you want to become a millionaire. So it's not going to guarantee that you can, but these are the 7 things you need to be working on, check off your list, and we'll get you started in the right direction. And that's at lyndapjones.com or Be Wealthy and Smart on iTunes or Stitcher Radio.
All right, and that's what people have to do immediately. And Joe, what do people immediately have to do at Stacking Benjamins?
Well, immediately coming down to the basement is New York Times bestselling author John Acuff,
wow,
who is talking about actually giving yourself the gift of getting things done. You know how we always start stuff and we get about halfway
Did we lose you?
Was that his joke?
I think we lost you, Joe.
Oh, look at that. Joe didn't even finish. I guess he was abducted by aliens down from the basement. Well, over here at richasaking.com on the Rich as a King blog, I wrote a piece recently for people who want to invest in real estate and make money by collecting the income, but they don't want to get involved with all the problems. And I wrote a piece about how you can actually invest in real estate and how you can find out the ways of making money doing just that. That is all at richasaking.com/blog. All right, that wraps it up for us today. Thank you all very much for joining us. I'm going to ask the wonderful Miranda Marquette to take us out.
Thank you for joining us for the Money Tree podcast this week. Remember to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and also on Stitcher, and coming soon to Google Play. We'll be doing that fairly soon as well, so be watching for that. Make sure you check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for all of our episodes, our archives, and a few more resources that you can use, as well as links to our own individual websites. And don't forget, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.